I'd like to join a long list of men who have expressed their appreciation for this congregation and for putting on this excellent lectureship. We have one at Bear Valley, too, and so I'm on the backside of the lectureships and understand a little bit about what goes on as far as trying to get everything together and the organization and so on, and there is so much involved, and you do a tremendous job. And I'm very impressed. I appreciate all of the hard work and all of the different hands that have to be involved in order to make something like this happen in the first place. And so appreciate you, appreciate this congregation, especially this particular theme and the emphasis on sound doctrine is something that we very, very much appreciate and pray that the Lord will continue to bless you and this congregation and this lectureship for many years to come. There's a place in Colorado that I like to go, try to get there once a year if my schedule will allow me. It's just an amazingly beautiful place, a very pristine area that's got a beautiful lake. It's surrounded by mountains on all sides. You've got beautiful, colorful wildflowers that grow as well as an assortment of different trees. And it's just one of those places that you go where you just think, it's hard to imagine anything being better than this. And there have been a couple of times that I've thought when I've gone to this place that I sure wouldn't want to lose the opportunity to come here. It's such a refreshing place. It's such an enjoyable place to come that it's really sort of become a part of my life. When we think about the Garden of Eden, how could it have been more perfect? When we read the text in Genesis, the Garden of Eden is presented as such an amazingly beautiful place. Certainly perfect in every aspect, with fruit trees everywhere, flowing rivers, precious metals in abundance. And then, of course, the greatest part of the garden was that God was present with man in the garden. He took care of man's loneliness by creating woman for him. All was well. But as we know and we study the text there in Genesis, that Satan is introduced into the narrative and everything turns south in a hurry as a result of Satan and his work. He initiated the fall of man, his separation from God, his removal from the garden. When we think about the Genesis account, we recognize how foundational it is for all of the Bible. It introduces so many theologically important ideas that without this section in Genesis, there would be so many gaps, so many holes, so many question marks that would be asked. But yet, because of the narrative that we have there in the early chapters of Genesis, we're able to understand about Satan, about sin, about temptation, law, separation, consequences, forgiveness. There are so many verses in the New Testament that really wouldn't make a whole lot of sense to us if we didn't have the account in the early chapters of Genesis. But you know as well as I do that there are those that are questioning, have questioned, many aspects of this narrative. And what we want to do is we want to basically break down the topic assigned into five distinct categories. We want to talk about the historicity of Satan in the Genesis account, the location of Satan's first temptation, the Garden of Eden. Third, we want to talk about the role of the serpent in the work of Satan, the methodology that Satan used to tempt Eve, and then short and long-term consequences of Satan's success in the garden. You know, when we think about the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis, you have certainly heard that these chapters have been viciously attacked. College, university, and seminary professors all over the U.S. and the world have discredited these chapters. And I'm sad to say that some of our own Christian colleges and some of our professors are guilty of this very sin of crediting this block of material to be in something that's nothing more than myth and fable. And it is something that we're going to have to become more aware of to make sure that our children are not being sent to places where they're going to hear this garbage, this false doctrine from these college professors. But when we think about those first 11 chapters, basically there are three approaches. One is that chapters 1 through 11 is nothing more than a fable, a fanciful myth that evolved through time. But the view that Genesis is a fable has a number of weaknesses. First of all, it doesn't account for the many references to these chapters throughout the Old and New Testaments. I didn't count them, but I know that there are dozens of references that bring us back to something that's found in chapters 1 through 11. It doesn't offer, secondly, an explanation of how Jesus could refer to these events and portray them as being historical. Third, it doesn't fit the nature of mythological literature. You know, when we read that which is fable or something that is myth, there are certain things that we pick up on right away that would indicate that this is meant to be a myth or fable, but this is not what we find here. Fourth, it doesn't account for the fact that for centuries these chapters were the foundation of beliefs in a number of civilizations. You don't build a civilization and the beliefs of a civilization upon a fable, but that is what we see happening with these chapters, and that would indicate that it's true history. A second view is that chapters 1 through 11 are allegorical, or maybe it's a combination of allegory and history. But the truth of the matter is that no writer of true history would mix plain matter of fact with allegory in one continued narrative. That's just something that is not done without maybe somehow giving us a heads up that we're sort of moving from that which happened historically into something that is now mythological. If Eve is an allegory, then Adam is an allegory. And if Adam's an allegory, then the garden, the tree, the river, and everything else is allegorical in that text. And so you've got to get the ball rolling, and there's nowhere to stop. And another thing that we've learned as we think about allegory is that it's so full of holes and weaknesses. The language is not allegorical. The proposed meanings of the allegories are so fanciful and wildly speculative that the entire section becomes worthless. Because those that have credited this section as being allegorical, they can't agree among themselves as to what Eve means or represents, or what Adam or what the tree represents, or anything else that's in, especially the text in chapter 3. Plus, we might wonder why Jesus, John, Paul, and numerous Old Testament writers regarded this material as true history. And so we're only left with one other alternative, and it is the only logical alternative, and that is that this whole section, chapters 1 through 11, are literal and historical. This is certainly the correct view, plus being literal doesn't prohibit our seeing deeper spiritual truths than what the text reveals. For example, Satan is not personally named in the narrative, but he's identified later on that he was the one that worked in the serpent to bring about the temptation and fall of Adam and Eve. So when we look at this, first of all, we see that it fits in a literal context. Second of all, we recognize that the language itself is literal. And then third, we recognize that it's viewed as literal throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, the objections that are offered to our text always center around three parts. They object to Satan. Second, they object to this tree, that if you would eat of that tree, you would acquire knowledge of good and evil. And then third, the other tree, that if you ate of that tree, you would have eternal life. Now, naturalists are those that don't believe there is anything supernatural in the world, never has been, never will be. And so they're going to, of course, disregard anything that's found in Genesis or any other place in the Bible in which something of a supernatural nature is being brought up. They're going to quickly dismiss the existence of Satan, God, trees that had special powers. Yet those who acknowledge the existence of God can also logically reason to the existence of Satan. If God exists as a spiritual being in a spiritual realm, then we're not going to have any trouble then moving into a belief that there could be and is, in fact, a Satan. And God frequently used instruments to teach spiritual truths. He used Moses' staff. He used a pillar of fire that guided the Israelites. The implements in the tabernacle were those that had spiritual lessons that were assigned with those. It's not unreasonable that he would employ trees. Now, when we think about the creation of man, God could have made man immortal. He could have given him knowledge of good and evil, could have created him that way. But the way God designed it was because God created man to be free moral agents. He could have created mindless puppets that had no choice but to praise him. He could have done that. If we're free moral agents, then an environment had to be created that would test our devotion. God desires loyalty and faithfulness and obedience from those who choose to be faithful and loyal and obedient. And he's going to reward that loyalty. Adam and Eve were put in an environment as free moral agents that were going to test their loyalty and dedication to God. All right, let's move on, though, and talk about the second section, and that is the location of Satan's first temptation, the Garden of Eden. You know, this has been a fascinating study, and certainly you've read that there have been those that have postulated various places on where the garden was to be located, those that consider it to be a literal place. Since the garden is described as a perfect place, it'd be a place that you'd like to go visit. I certainly would. Years of scholarly research and investigation have produced no consensus at all as to where the Garden of Eden is located. One considers that we've got those that suggest East Asia, the North Pole, Egypt, Iran, Turkey, Samaria, Armenia, or possibly Mesopotamia. The most fanciful, though, of all of the proposed theories is that postulated by the Mormon Church, and that is that the Garden of Eden is found in Jackson County, Missouri. Now, I've been to Missouri, and it is a pretty place, and it very well could be where we have qualities similar to the garden. The 10th Mormon president, Joseph Fielding Smith, said, "In accord with the revelations given to the prophet Joseph Smith, we teach that the Garden of Eden was on the American continent, located where the city of Zion or the New Jerusalem will be built. When Adam and Eve were driven out of the garden, they eventually dwelt at a place called Adam Andi Amon, situated in what is now Davies County, Missouri." And then Orson Pratt, LDS apostle, he said, "We may, however, observe that so far as new revelation has given us information on this subject, this continent of ours may be ranked among the first lands occupied by the human family. The very first man who had dominion on the face of the earth, under the direction of the heavens, once dwelt on this continent. His name was Adam." And then he goes on later on in this particular speech, says, "It was on this land where Noah built his ark." Probably didn't know that either, did you? "Noah built his ark, which was blown by the winds of heaven away to the east and landed on Ararat." Well, the biblical account offers the following pieces of evidence. First of all, Eden was a place where God planted a garden, and this garden was situated in the eastern part of Eden, chapter 2, verse 8. Second, a river from Eden watered the garden as it flowed through, chapter 2, verse 10. Third, a river branched into four rivers as it exited the garden, chapter 2 and verse 10. And then fourth, the rivers are called by name, three of which are associated with known geographical landmarks. Now, this information is sufficient to eliminate Missouri as a viable option, especially since the Euphrates is mentioned, and I don't believe that the Euphrates is located in Missouri. But it still opens the door to a few possibilities, and the most logical seems to be somewhere in the Mesopotamian Valley. Scholar R.K. Harrison said, "On the basis of currently available information It would appear that the one that locates Eden near the head of the Persian Gulf combines the greatest number of probabilities of every kind. Now, those that discredit Eden as being a real place point out that no such place exists today. That if the garden had ever been real, it would be real today. But that argument is so shallow and weak and certainly not well studied, because there are many areas on the earth that are no longer as they once were. Evolutionists, atheists have long recognized that our planet has gone through numerous climate and geographical changes. And, you know, the evidence shows that at one time the North Pole enjoyed a temperate climate, but that's certainly not the case now. Equally, there's evidence that at one time the entire planet had a temperate climate. But the Earth has undergone numerous changes over the years, with the greatest impact being that of Noah's flood. So it's logical to argue that the flood removed Eden from the face of the Earth, as well as other ecological and climate changes. Now, the garden is described in beautiful language, and it certainly was the ideal place for man to live, for man to flourish, and it's a fitting testimony to God's love and care for man to create such a beautiful place, and then in such a loving, tender way to locate man in this beautiful place. But all of this points to the foolishness of sin. How could Satan possibly come up with a temptation that would entice Eve when she was given so much? In view of all the liberties provided, eat of every tree but one. In view of the beauty of the garden, plus the consequences of sin, how did Satan pull this off? How did Satan manage to succeed in bringing about the first sin? Well, in this study of Genesis chapter 3, we really have a chance to get a glimpse into the way Satan works. So let's go to the third section of our talk, and that is the role of the serpent in the work of Satan. The fundamental question that's been asked is, was the snake Satan, or did Satan merely use the snake as his instrument? And there are five observations that I believe we need to make. First, there's nothing in the Genesis account to identify the tempter as Satan. The text merely identifies him as the serpent. Second, it's not until Revelation chapter 12 and verse 9 that Satan is called the serpent of old, using terminology that certainly brings us back to the Genesis account. So that's where we place Satan in the garden. Third, the New Testament identifies Satan as the tempter in the garden, 2 Corinthians 11, 3, 1 Timothy 2, and verse 14. Fourth, the oldest Jewish interpretation argued that the serpent was merely symbolic of Satan. And then fifth, it's significant that the condemnation issued in verse 15 is only to the serpent, not to Satan. With these points in view, it seems logical to argue that Satan chose to use the body of the snake as his instrument to tempt Eve. And so the snake was not Satan, but the snake was that which was used by Satan. Now, if this is true, then it leads us to some interesting observations. First of all, it demonstrates the ability of Satan to inhabit the body of one of God's creatures. The point ought not to surprise us, because in the New Testament we see demon possession. We are also reminded of how God used a donkey in Numbers 22 to speak to Balaam. That doesn't mean or suggest, though, that Satan has that power today. I do not personally believe that he does. Second, it shows the craftiness of Satan. He knew that if he should approach Eve in human form, his evil intentions would have been revealed, because Eve certainly knew that there was only one other human in the garden, and that was Adam. And so if Satan came in the form of a human, she would have that would have frightened her, or at least made her suspicious. In addition, Satan would not have wanted to come to Eve in his spiritual form, lest he frighten her with his superior condition and ability. So what did he choose to do? And here the craftiness comes out. He chose to use a creature of which Eve would have been familiar. And because of familiarity, there was going to be a certain level of comfort. And so that would reduce her level of fear, make her more comfortable in his presence. We also need to recognize, too, that the form of the creature apparently is not like the snake that we know today. Rather, Moses simply describes him as one of the beasts of the field, which Jehovah God had made. And then also, this shows the character of Satan. By choosing the serpent, he chose a creature of God that had a character attributes was very much like his own. And that is that the text says that the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field that God had made. When we talk about and we look at this Hebrew word that is translated as being subtle, we recognize that sometimes this word is in a good sense, meaning the idea of prudent or cautious. Sometimes it's in a bad sense as being crafty, sneaky. Now, when I was in college at York College, they had a rule, no snakes in the dorm room. But I have to confess that I had a boa constrictor in my dorm room at York College. And being the creative person I was back in those days, I named him Boa. Well, whenever it was feeding time, everybody on the dorm room would cram into my, on the floor of the dorm, they would cram into my room because they wanted to see Bo at work. And you'd drop a mouse in there and he would instantly freeze. And as the mouse was kind of moving around and sometimes would sense danger, sometimes wouldn't, but Bo wasn't moving. And if the mouse would turn away, then he would move ever so slightly because he was wanting to strike at exactly the right moment, at exactly the right place. And probably over the course of the several months that I had Bo in the dorm room, he probably ate 30 or 40 mice. Every single one, he got right over the head. It didn't make any difference which direction the mouse was facing. Bo was crafty enough that he was able to manipulate the situation where he could strike and always succeed exactly the way he wanted to. Well, when I think of craftiness, I think about that particular attribute of snakes and their ability to check out a situation and determine the best way to guarantee success. And that certainly describes the way Satan works. So he picked a creature that was more like his nature, one that would manifest his characteristic that he most admired. Satan needed to deceive Eve. He needed to trick Eve. And choosing a creature that had an ability to be subtle was a perfect fit. And then fourth, it demonstrates the awareness of Satan. He was well aware of the command of God. He knew exactly what needed to be done to bring about the fall of man. And knowing the command of God, Satan also had to devise an approach that would reduce the significance and consequences should one violate God's edict. All right, so let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about the methodology that Satan used to tempt Eve. You know, when we think about it, just kind of back up from the text a little bit, the bottom line was that Satan's approach to Eve was brilliant. It was simple. It was effective. First of all, he began by asking a simple question. He said, "Yea, hath God said, ye shall not eat of any tree of the garden?" Harmless question. Or so it seems. What could be so bad about asking a question about God's ruling? Eve, what did God say? Yet in this approach, he notices a subtle attempt to expose the injustice of God. Did God restrict you from every tree in the garden? Also, the question was raised, to draw out the feelings of the woman, her perception of God's ordinance. You see, God wants us to, or Satan wants us to form an opinion and to feel like that opinion carries some weight when it comes to the law of God. Let me say that again. Satan wants us to form an opinion and to believe that that opinion carries some weight when it comes to the laws of God. What did God say? What was his legislation about that? Second, the question doesn't give God the full respect that he deserves. As we're reading through the Genesis narrative, we notice in chapter 2, for example, the repetition of the phrase Jehovah God, 11 times just in chapter 2 do you have that phrase, and every time after our text in chapter 3, 1 through 6, it goes back to Jehovah God. But when Satan is making reference to Jehovah God, he omits the personal name of the Lord, and by doing this, he accomplishes his primary goal, and that is to minimize the power of the lawgiver, but also, I believe, by making it more impersonal. Third, Satan capitalized upon Eve's weakness. Whether Satan perceived resentment in her response can't be proven with certainty, yet her response demonstrated a bold addition to the divine command. Neither shall you touch it. Well, where did the text ever say that? When did God ever so decree that the fruit could not be touched? This was no small alteration to the divine command. Sometimes we're tempted to have a little pity party, feeling like God's commands are just too hard, too unattainable. And so we want to frame everything as the impossible that's been put upon our shoulders. Perhaps that's what Satan was drawing out of Eve. Fourth, Satan presents an overt contradiction to God's edict. He boldly asserts, "You shall not surely die." This statement is as startling as it is audacious. In making it, Satan's equating himself with the one who made the law. Better, he's showing himself superior to the one who made the law. Somehow, Satan knows the truth. Somehow, Satan knows better the true result of violation. Inherent in this claim is that Satan himself will protect them, that he will be able to bring about a different result than the one God decreed. You know, in Luke chapter 8, as Jesus is telling the parable of the sower, as the sower is sowing the seed, it lands upon the path. Satan wants to come and he wants to steal the seed. The seed is the word of God. And from the beginning until the end of time, Satan is always going to be very proactive in trying to do this very thing. Because James says in James chapter 1 and verse 21 that it's the implanted word that is able to save your souls. And so if Satan can keep the word from being implanted, then of course the soul is going to be lost rather than saved. We see this with Eve. He's trying to discredit the word of God. He's trying to bring question marks upon the decree of God in regard to what could or could not take place in the garden. And then fifth, Satan minimizes or reduces to insignificance the consequence of violating God's command. He says to Eve, "You shall not surely die." God said she would die. Satan says, "No, you won't." So who's to be believed? Satan is betting that he will be trusted. If he can get Eve to believe that God will not do what he said he would do, then he wins. Have you ever thought about Hebrews 3 and verse 13, where the Hebrew writer says, "Encourage one another day after day, as long as it is still called today, lest anyone be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin." How is sin deceitful? Well, in a lot of different ways, but in one way that sin is deceitful is in its consequences. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, "Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly. Therefore, the hearts of sons of men are given fully to do evil. Satan wants us to believe that we can sin and get away with it. Satan wants us to believe that we can sin and there are going to be no consequences to that sin. And the fact that in God's scheme of things, that there is not immediate justice that's rendered when we have sinned, like with Nadab and Abihu, for example, in Leviticus 10, that maybe we're going to get away with it. Maybe that lie I told is not going to have any consequence. Maybe that fit of rage is not going to be something that will come back to haunt me. That's what Satan is doing here. He's trying to get Eve to say, you know, you won't die. God said you will, but bottom line, it's not going to happen. And then sixth, Satan glorifies the value or the benefits of sin. He explains to Eve that by eating, she'll will achieve the ultimate. She will be as God. She'll be as God. Well, it's always been a ploy of Satan to sell the benefits over consequences. The pleasures of sins are worth it, he claims. You can go ahead and do this, but look at the benefits. Look at the plus. In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 25, it says regarding Moses, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the, now listen, passing pleasures of sin. This is one of the few passages in all the Bible that actually calls sin pleasurable. But yet it also tacks on the idea that it's passing pleasures of sin. It's something that's certainly not going to last. And then seventh, Satan appeals to three areas of human weakness. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life. When we see those three areas, we certainly see it manifested in the garden. And then there's an eighth point as well, and those of you that are following in the book are saying, there's no eighth point here, but this is a lectureship bonus. Satan attacks us in the environment that we're in. He attacks us in the environment we're in. He looked around the garden and determined what he could use to bring about failure. He did the same with Job, with Job's possession, with his family, with his health. And he does the same with us. What he does is he takes you and the world in which you live and uses what is a part of your life and tries to put together a game plan in how your world can bring about your fall. You know, Bear Valley has extension schools in eight different countries. And in those extension schools, I've traveled to them and I've taught the men in those various environments in Ukraine, in Africa, in Central America, South America, in Cambodia. And all of those places are very, very different from each other. And it's interesting to see how the temptations that those people face in those various countries are in many ways very different than the temptations we face. In some ways, they're still the same. But Satan uses the environment that we're in. When we talk about the short and long-term consequences, the fifth and final part, we can see that there it was a surprisingly easy success for Satan. I've often wondered, what was his plan B if plan A failed? Ever thought about that? But we'll never know. But the point of the matter is plan A succeeded. And Adam and Eve faced the full consequences of God's wrath. Well, Satan learned something that day. He learned about mankind's lust. He learned about man's prideful nature. He learned how one person can influence another person to sin. And fourth, he learned how God would respond to sin. But there are also some long-term consequences that we learn from this. It set an example to all men in every succeeding generation because the first sin is always the most important sin. Adam crossed the line, and all men from that point on have crossed the line. Like Paul said in Romans 5 and verse 12, therefore through one man, sin entered the world. But this doesn't mean that Adam's sin was passed on, the doctrine of inherited sin, because Paul clearly states there, for all have sinned, not in the likeness of Adam's offense, but all have in fact sinned. Second long-term consequence was it brought death into the world. And then third, we learn about the insidious nature of sin and about the nature of Satan. You know, the word wisdom in the Bible is a word that frequently we simply describe as the ability to use knowledge, the right way of using information that's been acquired. But you know what? In the New Testament, the word wisdom carries the idea of seeing things the way God sees them. If you're wise, you're wise because you see things the way God sees them. And that's true wisdom. You know, Satan was able to get Eve and Adam to not really see this sin as all that big a deal. But you know what? It was a big deal with God. If we're wise, then we develop the ability to see things the way God sees them. When we think about another lesson that was learned, and again, this is not in the book, it introduced the compassionate and forgiving character of God. I've often wondered how much this might have caught Satan off guard. He heard the decree, on the day that you eat, you shall surely die. But he certainly would not have been aware of the compassionate and forgiving nature of God. When we look at this and we think of so many accounts in the Bible, we see a very compassionate and forgiving God who, even though Satan might have success for a moment, God wins for eternity. And that's one of the great lessons that we learn beginning with this account in Genesis chapter 3. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 2:11 that we need that no advantage be gained over us by Satan, for we're not ignorant of his schemes. And so we need to certainly be aware and be prepared that Satan is going to figure out a way to get us to fall. Like Adam and Eve, we've got a lot to lose. We can't allow Satan to be victorious over us. And thanks to the work of Christ, we can win, and we will win. God bless you.